Hey, conscious leaders, hope you're doing well and a warm welcome to yet another episode on the Carmen Murray Show, joined by all the conscious leaders. Thank you so much for our audience joining in today. I would like to express my gratitude to each one of you. As you know, the show is always evolving and we are now truly moving into a new era of the show where we're really trying to unpack the stories of remarkable, resilient women. And through their stories, hopefully you can see a bit of yourself in their stories. We can learn from each other, but storytelling is also so essential to pull down the layers and to learn from each other and also to have empathy. And it's also a form of activism and to show that vulnerability is actually the deepest way in how we can connect. And I hope that you would enjoy today's story. It is a remarkable story from Riveshni Naidu joining us here today. She is a force of nature. Welcome.
Thank you, Carmen. Thank you for having me.
So before I actually introduce you, I think it's better for you to tell us, who are you? What are you all about? And tell me a little bit about what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, so Riveshni Naidu, as you said. I am a mum with twin girls. Single mum of twin girls. I work in the sustainability and ESG space for Sun International. I've actually been there the longest I've ever been in my entire career, so that says a lot. I've had changes in my career over the last almost 20 years itself. I have two dogs. For me to have the life that I have and to be able to do the things that I have a very good support structure. I have my wonderful helper that lives in with me, Charity, and her daughter as well, Gugu, that is 2 years old. So it's a house full of women. With the exception of one dog, Rocky, my dog Rocky. I wouldn't be where I am today without the love and support that I get from my family, friends, and even my colleagues at work. Mm. And to be able to do what I do. I think that's the most important thing, is to build that network and that support structure that's there to help you. I never really had that before, professionally, I would say. And I think, with the changes that I've had in my life, I've learned that I can't do everything myself. I need to be able to stop and ask for help where I need it. And that was very difficult for me to do because I was a person, and I use the word was because that's what it is. I was a person that thought I needed to do everything myself. I had a bit too much pride in wanting to ask for help. And when I realized that, you know what, there's actually nothing wrong with that. There's actually nothing wrong with letting go of control, of being vulnerable, of being able to ask for help and assistance when you need it. It's not a bad thing. It's not showing weakness. It's actually showing that, you know, you've identified where you need help and there's nothing wrong with asking for help. I've had a lot of help along the way to get me to where I am now and to be the person that can be a good role model for my children, for my nieces and my nephew, because I hear it from them. And I've realized in my working environment that there are other women that look to me, that come to me, that ask me for advice, you know, once they've heard a little bit of what my journey has been, specifically over the last 5 years, in terms of how I've had to learn to be resilient. Make difficult decisions. I've had a lot of women come up and ask me, you know, how did you manage through this? What did you do? Etc. And for me, it's now become something of, you know what, I actually like sharing my story, like telling people, you know, these are the things that I've been through and what I've had to do to overcome it, and that I haven't done it on my own. I've had help along the way. So I think that's the key message I would say, is that, you know, no matter what you're going through, no matter how hard it is, at that moment in time, it looks like you won't get past it. But when you sit back, like where I am now, like 5 years later, and I look at where I was and where I am now, I realize that all of us have a lot of strength within us. We're strong. We are resilient. We have the tools within us to overcome anything. It's just a matter of having that belief and tapping into it.
I love that. You know, I actually want to ask you a question. So being a single mom with twins is a huge responsibility. I think before we even start getting into that, I would really like to know the journey of becoming a mom. I myself, I am not a mom, and I always love to hear what that journey was, falling pregnant, and, you know, what motherhood means to you.
Okay. So I think I always wanted to become a mom. So I was 18 when my eldest niece was born. So she was born in 2000. And I had just started university, and every holiday I used to come up to Joburg. And I must say, my eldest brother and his wife, they trusted me to look after my niece, Charissa. And that's where I learned, you know, how to take care of kids and be responsible, etc. So when I eventually got married in 2010, it was actually very difficult for me to actually fall pregnant. And, you know, we tried IVF first round, nothing happened. And so we gave it a bit of a break. And in 2015, we decided to try again, IVF. And I was 34 at the time. 2016. I was 34 at the time. And I said, you know what, this is going to be my one and only shot at trying to become a mother. And so I went through the whole IVF process, and it was difficult, you know, going for the checks, doing the medication, the injections. My husband at the time, he was very reluctant to inject me with the needle because he saw the needle, and I was like, okay, so I've got to be strong enough to do this myself, you know, to pinch the fat, put the needle in, and you know, it was difficult, but I did it. And the very first time that we went in and we needed to extract eggs, so the whole process is, you know, they pump you full of the meds, and then you go in, they see how many eggs you've got. When I did that first round and I went in and I only had like 3 eggs, and the doctor said, you know what, it's not worthwhile to actually extract those 3 eggs.
Wow.
I felt so disappointed in myself.
Can I ask you something? Why did you feel disappointed in yourself?
Because it was, for me, it was, I was getting the help to do something. But again, it's my mindset at that time. I was getting the help to do something. But my body was failing me. And in a way, I felt like I was failing myself. I was heartbroken that day. I went home. I laid on the couch and I was like crying. Because I was like, I failed at this. Where I was getting help. So what the doctor actually told me was, listen, we're not going to go through that full process where we extract the eggs and everything. Let's just see. So we canceled that round. And they were very good to me. They actually credited me for part of the procedure itself. So then I went in again. I told the doctor, listen, this is hit or miss now. I want you to give me the strongest meds. I'm going to do everything on the next level. So we did that. Went in and I had produced 8 eggs.
Wow.
So like, okay, we're in this to win it now, right? So we went through the process and extracted. They did the whole fertilization, etc. And so we chose the 22nd of September. So the 22nd of September is my ex-husband's birthday, to actually implant the eggs in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we went in, sat there. Now, you've got to have like this full bladder to do this story. And they were taking so long. And eventually I got in, and the doctor that did it for me, Dr. Gobetz, he's at Vitalab, and I'm sitting there and I'm waiting, I'm thinking, shit, if this doctor pokes me down there, I think my blood is going to burst, right? It's going to burst. Like, he goes in, and true to God, I wee. Because my bladder is so full.
Oh, my goodness.
But he's done it already. He's like, they showed me the 2. So out of that process of 8 eggs, I had 3 embryos. And I immediately told the doctor, listen, we're going to put 2 in.
Mm.
So he put the 2 in, did it, and it was a Friday. I think it was a Friday. That Monday, I started feeling some cramping and stuff happening. Something, okay, things are happening.
Oh,
here.
My word.
And when I went for my checkup, no, first I went for the test. When I went for the test, now type A personality, I was like, what do your levels need to be to know that you're pregnant? So now I went there and they did the pregnancy test and they told me, okay, yes, you're pregnant. This is what your levels are. Immediately me, type A personality. I went, I Googled, okay, if my levels are this, what does it mean? And then it says, you could possibly be having a multiple pregnancies. I'm like, okay.
Oh my gosh, so you didn't plan for that?
No, I didn't plan for that, right? So we put two in with the hope that at least one would take, right? So when I'm looking at the numbers, I'm thinking, yeah, I suspect I might be having two. That's not jinxed it yet. So I was sitting in the office the one day, and I went to the bathroom, and I saw spotting blood. And I freaked out.
Oh, no.
I freaked out. I phoned VitaLab and I said, listen. And I spoke to my doctor. I said, listen, Dr. Falching. And I said, I've got bleeding and I'm worried. He's like, come in. I went in and I went myself. So my husband at the time, he was at work. I didn't phone anybody else. I just went myself. I got there. I go in. I sit down. And he's got the ultrasound machine. And he shows me two heartbeats.
Oh my word. I'm actually getting goosies. Oh my word.
He showed me, it's like the slightest flutter that you see. And there were two there.
Oh,
and I was like, oh my gosh, two. I didn't go back to work. I went first to my parents' house to tell my parents, because my parents knew the struggle I had. Like, so I come from a Tamil background, and my mother's aunties, my mother, everybody. We did a whole lot of prayers, you know, wanting for me to actually fall pregnant. And so when I went there and I told my mother, you know, I told my parents, listen, having twins, I'm pregnant, it's twins. I like burst into tears while I was there. And same day, I phoned my brothers, my sister-in-laws, and I told them, you know what, this is it, twins, having twins. And I think when I found that out, it was a relief to know that, you know, I was having not just one, but two, and that they would at least have each other. And so that journey then started with the pregnancy. And because I was 34 and it was twins and it was done through IVF, first thing my brother and my sister-in-law said, right, we're going to find you the best doctor to go to at the right hospital where, if by chance, you had to give birth early, your girls or your kids would be fine. So my brother got me in and my sister-in-law got me in at Sandringham Hospital with Dr. Kiriazis. Brilliant woman, I love her. Best doctor ever. I'll tell you why. So I went and I saw her and she got me to go to see the fetal medicine specialist, etc. And I did all those things. And I can hand on heart say I was the healthiest I was ever in my life when I was pregnant. I cut out all the sweet stuff, cool drinks, everything. I was on fruit, healthy stuff. My mother had me on a whole lot of vegetables. Like in the Indian culture, you must have herbs if you want to have hair. You need to have bindi or okra for the braid, everything. My mother pumped me full of everything. I stayed away from all processed stuff, etc. And when it came to February, and why I remember this is I was like around about 20 somewhat weeks, right? And my ex-husband at the time, he went for ultra for the weekend with his friends. I was like, you know what, you go. I'm going to be at home. I'm going to be figuring out stuff. I'm going to be checking out the kids' room, what I'm going to do, etc. And I think that weekend, because I did that, you know, I was like standing up. I was picking up things from the top, putting it away, whatever. When I went for my checkup, and it was the end of February, I went for a checkup and everything was fine. And then the doctor said, you know what, you're looking good, everything looks fine. It was around about almost 24 weeks, 1st of March. Very first day I decided to wear a pregnancy dress, beautiful black dress that I had bought. First day I decided to wear it and I went to work. At 9 o'clock in the morning, the sister at the doctor's rooms calls me and says, listen, doctor wants you to come in, because when I had went for my checkup, she could see that the cervix was opening. She says, no, doctor wants you to come in. She wants to put in a stitch. So I was like, okay, fine. What time? She's like, no, you need to come in today. I'm like, okay. So I get to the hospital, go in, go under. She does everything. I'm in there.
Sure.
I get discharged. Yeah, I do get discharged. And then we see that, you know, my blood pressure is elevated. And she did a test and she could see that there was protein in my urine. So things were not looking lekker. So that Friday, She books me in. She says, come in. This is not a 24 weeks. Come in. They give me steroid injections for lung development. Now, this is 24 weeks now. And I'm at Sandhill Hospital. And I'm like, okay, so now those injections are like painful. But I did it that weekend. I stayed in hospital that weekend. They gave me the injections. And my sister-in-law told me, you know what? If you had to deliver early, at least they've given you the injections for the kids, for the lung development. So I was okay with that. So then I got discharged the following week. But I was advised to not go into the office because I was still not out of the woods yet. So just to fast forward, so during the course of March, I was in and out of hospital because of my elevated blood pressure and the protein in my urine. Towards the end of March, I got sick. And along the way as well, I was starting to get some anxiety around what was happening. And my doctor was like, listen, I don't want you to have postnatal depression. So she put me on Zoloft.
Wow.
As a precaution, she put me on it. And when I got sick, and for me, it's like, you know, when you have your blocked ears and you can't take anything at that time, I felt trapped in my body. And I think that's where that whole anxiety started coming out. And I was scared to be alone at home, etc. But eventually I got sick to the point where I had to go back in. So I got back in, and this one day, this one picture I have on my phone, it's a picture of me sitting in the hospital bed, and I took a picture of myself because I was nebulized. And I could not remember even taking that picture. But I had sent it to my ex-husband at the time to tell him, like, this is what the current situation is. Sure. And in that period that I was there, my doctor was brilliant, amazing. It's like, it's not that she went looking for stuff, but she was always a step ahead. She had the best physician to assist me there. She had physiotherapists. She had everybody helping me to make sure that I could keep these babies in, basically. And it was the last week of March. It was a Monday. And she had already discharged me. And she said, no, come down just before 5. We just want to do one last ultrasound. She looked at it and she told me, listen, she had another doctor there. She told me, listen, your placenta, the baby's placenta is calcifying. You need to stay in hospital until you deliver. The next day, I got my laptop brought to the hospital. I did whatever I needed to do. I sent my boss an email. I told him, listen, I'm not coming back until these babies are born. And I'm not sure how long that's going to take. So I did what I needed to do. I had already also interviewed somebody. I had suggested, this is the person to bring in while I'm away on maternity leave that can take over the project. So I had a plan in place for that as well. So that was on a Tuesday. So on a Thursday, this is now the 30th of March, I'm there. You know, they come in the morning, they do your blood work, and then they periodically monitor the babies, etc. And so my doctor came around about, it was in the afternoon at 3 o'clock, it was visiting hours, and my parents were there with me. And they had just done the ultrasound or the checking the baby's heartbeats and stuff. And my doctor came in, and there was another doctor doing rounds, and now they're talking. And now she's talking to another doctor on the phone. And I'm like, okay, something's happening. And so she tells me, listen, one baby is going into distress. We need to take them out.
Sure.
And the other doctor agreed, like, you know, if you keep them in any longer, you could possibly lose one of them.
And what could happen to you, though, as well?
Exactly, what could happen to me. And my parents are sitting there, and they were going to leave. I said, no, wait, listen, let's see what the doctor has to say. And they said this. I told my parents, listen, you go home, my bag is packed, just bring my bag and come. And I phoned my ex-husband. I told him, listen, this is happening today. They literally just waited for him to come. So this was like about probably just before 4. By 5 o'clock, they had wheeled me in. So the sister had done the drip on the one hand for the anesthesiologist on one hand. When I get into the theater, it wasn't working. So they had to pull that out. And that's a thick needle now. And I'm like, ish. Look on the other hand. And I'm sitting there, and then they're about to give me the epidural. And I look at the needle and I say, listen, I've been poked and prodded. Just do what you need to do.
Sure.
So I'm sitting in there now. So we're going at 5, right? And now they're taking a while to actually get to the babies and stuff like that. And eventually at 5:50, the first one comes out. She comes out screaming. 3 minutes later, the next one comes out.
Wow.
Now the babies are out, and I could briefly see them because I can't really see that clearly without my glasses on. Briefly saw them, and then they put them in the incubators. But they put them in these plastic bags. And I'm trying to figure out, what the hell? The kids are in plastic bags. And then they put them in, they wheel them out. But now, there were some issues with me because I was losing a lot of blood.
Hmm.
The next thing I hear the doctor, they ask, you know, what is her blood type? The doctor's like saying it. And strangely enough, in the theater, the lights have mirrors on top. So you can't actually see And my ex-husband is telling me, listen, there's a lot of blood everywhere, etc. So they closed me up, everything. And as they're wheeling me out, she said, listen, it was a good thing we took them out because the one's placenta was about to rupture.
Sure. Oh, my goodness.
And the other one's umbilical cord didn't attach in properly to the placenta. So it wasn't in the right spot in it. So that's why she was smaller. So when my girls were born, Suhana was born at 840 grams. Suyara was born at just over a kilo.
Hmm.
And they were taken to the NICU. And as I'm wheeling out, my doctor, she's showing me the placenta, and then she tells me there and then, I don't ever want to see you pregnant again.
Oh, wow.
She says it was that difficult
close.
In there.
Sure.
That difficult in there.
Thank goodness you ate well during this time, right?
Exactly.
Can you imagine your mom didn't do what she did?
Exactly. And I'm like, but also, the one thing that happened when I was pregnant is that I actually lost weight rather than putting on weight.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is unusual.
And I had lost like 10 kilos.
How?
I have no idea. Maybe it's because I was healthy. But also, I was already overweight when I got pregnant. I had tried to lose, but you know what?
And your doctors didn't find that to be strange?
She didn't tell me anything.
Wow.
So anyway, so the
so
girls...
So that is a normal thing. It can happen. You can be pregnant and lose weight.
Yes, you can be pregnant and lose weight.
See? We don't stereotype.
Exactly. And so the babies went out, and like my brother and my sister were sitting there, and they were like, you know, why is it taking so long? So eventually I come out, go... And again, my doctor, she had the right sister that evening to look after me for the pain medication, etc. Now I haven't seen my babies. I mean, straight to my room. So the next morning, I was like, I'm going to wake up and go and see my babies. Even with that C-section scar or whatever, they lowered the bed for me. I went, I had a bath, and I was like, and I'm walking, I'm holding my my drip. And I'm walking down the hallway, and I get into the NICU. And I see
Is this your first time to see them?
This is my first time to see them.
Wow.
I go and I look at these babies, and they are tiny. When I say tiny in the sense that, you know, when babies are born these days, they've got like these nice round bum cheeks, they're all fleshy, etc. My babies had nothing. It was just like, you know, like your hand like this?
Yeah.
And there was just like a hole there. That's where
the
bum. It was there. And so the sister's like, you know, you need to get like these special nappies for them. Their nappies were like the size of my palm.
Wow.
The first nappy they had was the size of my palm.
How did you feel during this time? The first time seeing them, did you feel overwhelmed because you've seen everybody else's babies and your nieces and what they looked like? And then you have these petite, tiny little babies. What went through your mind at that time?
No, I was just grateful that... They were here.
Mm.
That both of them were there
and safe.
And you know, when I reflect back on that period of them, and so Suhana was in the NICU for 12 weeks, and Suyara was in for 10 weeks.
Mm.
And when I reflect back on that, it was literally they came out of my body because my body couldn't keep them in anymore to grow. My girls came out. You know, you hear these stories about babies in the NICU that are born at 29 weeks that have issues with their sight, you know, with development, with breathing, etc. My girls didn't have any of that.
Sure.
They literally came out because my body couldn't grow them.
Mm.
And in that NICU for that period, and I will forever be grateful to the doctors and the sisters there, all my girls had to do was just grow. And that's what they did. They just grew.
Mm.
And it was difficult. I mean, that first 6 weeks, like the first 2 weeks, my dad and my mom would take me and drive me to the hospital to see them, etc. And eventually I was like, you know what, I've got to have to learn to do this myself. So before 6 weeks, I started driving to go to the hospital to see my girls. So they were born on the 30th of March, right? And my birthday is on the 8th of April, so a week later. And so when I went to the hospital, and I hadn't carried them at all. Now, between the time they were born till that 8th, I didn't carry them. I told the sisters, listen, it's my birthday today. I'd like to carry at least one of my girls.
Oh, wow.
So they gave me Suyara to carry because she was the bigger of the two. And literally she like fitted in like just about here on me. And that was the first time I held my child.
Oh, man.
One at least. First time I held one. I had to wait a little bit longer to hold Suhana. And also when I look back and I think of my pregnancy, it's like, you know, when you tell people you're having twins, they assume you're going to have like this huge tummy. I just looked like I just put on like a little bit of weight.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
So I didn't have, so you know when people, when women have that wonderful, beautiful pregnancy where they're glowing and they've got that big belly and they take those lovely, beautiful pictures, you know.
Oh, with the,
yeah. You know, they take the pictures. And then also after your babies are born, you're able to take those beautiful pictures with them. I couldn't do any of that.
And do you regret that you couldn't do that? Or do you feel, when you look at the way that you were pregnant, did you compare yourself to what pregnant women should look like? Was that what was going through your head?
I don't think so. I think for me, it was a case of just the fact that I had struggled for so long.
Yeah.
The fact that I even managed to get pregnant.
I know. You see the gratitude.
To have the children was it for me. And, you know, it's funny enough, when people knew that I was struggling to get pregnant, they also felt very reluctant to share, you know, if they had good news.
Yeah.
In case that, you know, I would, you know, be upset or whatever. And strange enough, when I was pregnant, I really didn't share the news with a lot of people. It was immediate family, it was my work colleagues and a sprinkling of friends that knew I was pregnant. Because it was so hard to actually fall pregnant. It's something I kept very close, and my family kept it very close that, you know, she's actually having twins. And it was only after the twins had come home and stuff like that did they even post anything to say that, listen, I have twins. And people were surprised, like, really? We didn't even know you were pregnant. I was like, yeah, because I kept it close to my heart in terms of going through that process. But you know, when the girls came home, it was an adjustment. And you know, they were on this routine in hospital, and I was like, right, you're coming home, we sticking to that routine. And my mother came and stayed with me specifically in the evening.
I want to stop you there because I want to ask you a question that I'm sure, as we're all listening to the story, you're talking a lot about your mom. And you're talking a lot of family. What about your husband? Where was your husband during this time for you? Because the reason I'm asking is being pregnant with twins and even the news of becoming parents of two children is a big, it's a big change in your entire life. The structures, the finances, two children to school, there's a lot to think about. Take me a little bit down that journey for what that looked like during your pregnancy.
So, you know, so Neil is my ex-husband, right? And yes, he was supportive, right? We knew we had to restructure from a finance perspective. I mean, both of us had I was not at Sun International at that time. I was still working at my previous job, and he had a pretty decent job as well. So we knew we were in for it from a financial perspective, and we had a lot of support, not just from my family, but from his family as well that were helping us, right?
Wonderful.
And so when the girls came home, he spent a few days, you know, paternity leave isn't a lot of days.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was there. And he would help where he could help, right? But predominantly, the support and the assistance I needed came from my mom and from Charity, my helper, with the kids itself. And I think also a case of, you know, with him and him having to focus on, you know, work and doing those kind of things, I kind of kept the sorting out of the babies and running of the house and everything to myself. Also bearing in mind that during that period, I worked for a company where they did not do paid maternity leave.
Wow.
Right. So what happened was at the end of April, so after my 6 weeks, I went back to work.
After 6 weeks? Yeah. After the traumatic experience?
Yeah. So after 6 weeks, I went back to work. And I worked for a month before the girls came home because I needed to, you know, like you said, from a financial perspective. And I took the 4 months maternity leave. And so during that 4 months, it was tough. It was hard, right? So also, I didn't want to put too much of pressure on Neil in terms of the kids and stuff because there's only one person that's actually earning a salary in that period. So that's where the support came in from others to help me with them. So my mom stayed with us in the evenings up until September, and then she was like, you know, she's getting tired now. It was a lot, you know, waking up in the middle of the night to feed these kids 3-hourly.
And two of them.
That was a nightmare. At times it was a nightmare, but I'm always grateful for what the sisters at the hospital did in terms of getting these children into a routine, and we just maintained that when they came home. And so when I went back to work in September, October. And because I wasn't on paid maternity leave, I owed my previous company nothing. And that's then when I started looking for a new job. And this opportunity at Sun International came up. And I applied for it. And the person heading up the department then, I knew her because she gave me my first job.
Wasn't there a history with this lady?
Yes.
Please tell us more about it.
So I met her. So she gave me my first job when I started off in consulting. So I started off in consulting, and I worked in consulting for 10 years. And so I worked with her twice in consulting at two different companies. And then when I saw this opportunity at Sun International, I was like, okay, I'll apply for it. And afterwards, I'll phone her and I'll tell her I've applied for the job, which is what I did. And so I went for the interview. Everything went well. And one of the questions the HR lady asked me was, you know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I was like, when I see myself doing her job, you know, being in her position, that's what my aim is, you know, in 5 years. And so, you know, not a lot of people will want to say that, but that's where I saw myself going. And so everything went well. I got the job and I started in December. Now I've got twins that are 8-9 months old, right? Starting a new job. In December.
It's a lot.
And, you know, when my mom stopped staying with us to help me with the girls, you know, then Neil had to help me. But by that time, we had gotten to a point where the girls were kind of sleeping through the night. It was just one bottle in the evening. So it was okay. And so when I started at Sun, it was completely different from what I was doing because I had worked as a consultant for 10 years in environmental consulting. Working across different sectors. And during that period as well, there was a time where I was not working for around about 9 months, where the last consulting company I worked for, I left there. I wasn't working for 9 months until I got a job at a construction company, an international construction company, and I was there with them. And so joining Sun was a new challenge in itself. It was a whole new ball game. It was learning how to do different things. I got thrown into the world of integrated reporting, sustainability reporting.
I mean, that is quite an intense career because it's still it's not new,
but
it is the way that we want to take it is new and a very challenging career. Yeah. So
I joined in December, and in February, I needed to travel for the first time, and the babies are like 11 months, and I had to leave them.
Oh wow.
So I left them with my mom, The first time I left them, I cried. As soon as I left them, I cried because, you know, I was going to be away for a week, 2 weeks. Each week I was out for a few days. It was hard. And we also had a tragedy at that time, in the sense that my ex-husband's sister passed away in January 2018, and it was a difficult time. And the twins and her share a birthday. And so prior to that, I was busy planning a first birthday party for the twins, because it was a big thing, you know, firstly to have them and then to plan a party for them. And when his sister passed away, it was a tough time. We had to pull back on everything. And for their first birthday party, we actually had it at my parents' house, very small. His uncle and cousins, they came through, because it was a difficult day. I mean, his sister had just passed in January, and the twins and her share the same birthday. So we did something very low-key. But 2018 was a very difficult year all around, because started a new job, right? He went into a depression because his sister passed away. And it was difficult. I mean, you got one-year-olds, right, having to manage them, trying to make a mark or make a name for yourself in a new company, in a space that was where you were specifically brought in to internalize the portfolio, because previously it was outsourced to consultants. So there's a lot of pressure on you to actually deliver, and to also, I'm coming into a new sector, I needed to understand the business. So at one point, it was around about in May and June, I went to visit every single Sun International property around the country.
Sure.
To go and spend time, to meet the teams, to understand, to be able to come back and give feedback on where I see we are at and what needs to happen to change things moving forward. So it was a very difficult time. And as much as it was challenging, I was also going through, mentally I wasn't the right space, emotionally. I mean, I can tell you, in August 2018, I was looking at where I was in my life, and I was like, my babies are small, I'm not happy, my husband that's supposed to be supporting me and helping me is dealing with his own demons, his own, you know, challenges, etc. And I'll be honest, I mean, I didn't really have a very good relationship with my in-laws. I didn't. And now I'm sitting there thinking, you know what, can I actually do this on my own?
Sure.
And I realized I couldn't. I actually told myself, I will put up with this life that I'm currently living until my girls are 18.
Sure.
That is what I had told myself in 2018.
That is deep.
I told myself, listen, I will put up with whatever I need to put up with, because I wasn't in the right frame of mind to actually do it alone. I wasn't. And then that was 2018. So 2019 was kind of a turning point for me. It would have been 20 years out of high school. We were going to have a 20-year high school reunion, and I wanted to go for it. And I was like, I looked at myself, I was like, this is not the person I would like, you know, my classmates to see. So the beginning of 2019 is when I started this transformation journey for myself, if I can say it that way. My colleague at work, very good friend of mine, Sheena and I, we decided, right, we're going to get healthy and we're going to get fit. So we started eating better, we started exercising, and I lost weight. And I started feeling good about myself. And also, Neil and I started doing couples counseling. So we were actively making an effort to try and repair our relationship, how we communicated with each other. You know, what were some of the issues that were holding us back from actually having a good relationship? And, you know, there were a few months where, you know, things went really, really well. We could see that we were getting back on track. And then also in 2019, I realized, listen, the girls are going to be going to school soon. We're going to have to be able to pay for school fees and stuff. And so I'm the type of person, if I make a decision, that's it. We followed through. So I decided, listen.
You're all or nothing over there.
Yeah, it's all or nothing. So I had a really nice car, and I said, you know what? There's no point in me paying so much for a car like that. We've got two nice cars. Both of us don't need to have it. So I gave him my car. I got a smaller car, and I was like, right. Then COVID comes in 2020.
Oh, my. There comes the tree shaker.
Yeah, COVID comes in 2020, right? And so hospitality was hard hit. And in April, we went down to 40% salaries, right?
Oh, my gosh. Another thing.
Hit number one.
Oh, my word.
Hit number two is Neil got retrenched from his job.
Hmm.
So he was out of work. And now you have a family confined because of COVID. And so I let my helper go home because, you know, she needed to be with her husband. So it was just Neil and I handling these kids. And now, you know, he's in this situation where he doesn't have a job. I'm in the situation where I'm only getting 40% of my salary. How do we make these things work? So we tried. And then, so the creative side of me is I love baking. I love baking. And I taught myself how to bake. And so I had done a couple of cakes for like family and friends, etc. And my sister-in-law's cousin, I actually did a Peppa Pig cake for a daughter. And she said, Rashni, why don't you do this as a business? You know, why don't you bake and sell and stuff like that? And, you know, I sat there, thought about it, and I was like, you know what, she's right. So I think it was in June. I decided to do it. So
wow.
I set up a logo for myself, I got a name, I set up an Instagram page, a Facebook page for this baking thing for me. I was like, I had to also make money somehow, right? So I set up a little baking business called Wistful Creations. And I started doing birthday cakes. I've done wedding cakes, like 4-tier wedding cakes.
Jeez, like Ravishni.
Yeah.
Like so, there's so many hidden aspects to you. I started
learning how to do other things, right? And took off during that period. And I think it was a creative outlet that I needed for myself because I wasn't doing my technical work.
Mm.
I felt my mind wasn't being engaged. So I needed to do something to keep myself busy, right? So I started that little home kind of baking business kind of thing. And the second turning point and the major turning point in my life happened on the 1st of July, 2020. I was at home. I was doing some work. Neil comes in and tells me, I need to go help my cousin. He's moving. I looked at him and said, are you sure you're looking a bit tired? Are you sure you're okay to go and help him? He's like, yeah. I was like, something is telling me you should just stay at home. Don't go anywhere. Because I can see you're not feeling good. But he went either way. I think it was just after 12. I get a phone call. He tells me, listen, I've been in a car accident.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, what happened? He's like, I can't remember. I said, okay, where are you? I'm coming now. I jump in my car. I get there. As I'm driving, it's in Kailami. So as you go up the one road in Kailami, and I can see this car, and I'm looking to myself, and I'm thinking, how the hell did this guy survive this? Because his car... And he had a Ford Ranger, so the full front was pushed in.
Sure.
I get there, I look at him, ask him, what happened? He's like, I don't know. I blacked out. I was like, and I'm seeing these other people here now, and I'm like, they're probably thinking he is either high or he's intoxicated or whatever. Meanwhile, this man is just actually tired. So his one friend was there. I told him, listen, you take him to the car. I sorted out the situation. I took him. We went home. But it was also it was a turning point for both of us because...
It's like a near-death experience,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Mm. It was. And something had to happen. Something had to give. And so with the support of his family as well, he went into a Akiso clinic in Randburg, right? So he had to see a psychologist, psychiatrist, etc. And part of the therapy there is I had to go and see his psychologist. Mm. So I went and I saw her and I'm sitting, I'm chatting to her. She looks at me and she asks me, how is it that you are not seeing somebody? I was like, why? It's like, you've got so much that you're dealing with. How is it that you are coping? I was like, I don't know, I'm just coping. She says, well, I think you should speak to somebody. So I'm like, okay. And so she introduced me to my psychologist, who I still see today, Leontine. And Leontine helped me find myself again.
Which is so important.
Yeah.
And I just want to reflect on this for a moment. You know, what you're typically explaining here is the prima materia. It is going through the deepest, darkest parts of your life. And now you're in this undefined era. It's like every foundation. You've got these two beautiful daughters.
Exactly.
A miracle that happened in itself. Something to be so grateful for. But around it, the structures are just falling apart and collapsing. And you also in a place where you need to fortify yourself.
Exactly.
In order to be strong for everything and everyone around you. So kudos to you for actually putting your hand up and saying, I need help. I need somebody. I need to put my trust in somebody else's hands, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, like, up until that point, I mean, we had issues in our marriage. And I thought, listen, I'm not the one with the problem. He's the one with the problem. And I realized, you know, when I went to see Leontine that, you know, I have flaws. There are things that I do that probably people don't like. I realized that, you know, the way I grew up, what my role model for a relationship looked like, influenced my choice in a partner, the type of partner, the type of life I was living. And there were some very difficult conversations I had to have with my parents. There were very difficult conversations I had to have with the psychologist in terms of, you know, why is it that I am the way I am? What has influenced me being at this point in my 30s with the type of partner I have, dealing with the issues that I'm dealing with? And it was hard. It's hard when you've got a, you know, really do introspection and look at yourself and call yourself out on your negative elements or what your flaws are. And during that period, it was from August to December, I saw sides of myself that I didn't like. You know, like, you know they say sometimes you got to go hit like rock bottom. You got to go to that deep, dark, dark place.
The dark nights of the soul.
Where you see the ugliest version of yourself.
Yes, yes.
The side that you're like, yo, could I actually go to those depths? I went there. And I realized that's not for me. I realized that Neil and I were bringing out the worst in each other rather than the best in each other. And it wasn't, and we weren't happy. We weren't going to be the best parents for these two beautiful children that we decided to bring into the world.
I want to applaud you, though. I think listening to your story where you said that you were going to put up with all of this despite of just so that they could have a happy childhood or that everything can be normal until they go out of the home. So many times children have to endure two parents discontent with each other, not loving each other and really witnessing an unhealthy relationship and sticking it out. Whereas you had the courage and both of you had the courage to say this is not working, right? Don't you think that that is the most liberating thing if you look back at it right now?
It is. And you know, we had actually gotten to a point where we were actually in a good space. And, you know, sometimes you come to that crossroads where you've got to make decisions.
Sure, it's hard.
And kind of like Neil went down a path that not just myself, but even the two psychologists. So how it worked was we each saw different psychologists, but then we came together and we had like joint sessions.
Oh, wow.
And so the thing was, it wasn't a case of we're doing this to make sure we stay together. We're doing this to decide whether we actually want to be together.
Oh, I love that. Such a different outcome.
It's a different outcome. It wasn't to say like, you know, we're going to work hard so that we can stay together. It was to work out individually and then come together to decide whether this is for us, whether we are for each other. And at this one juncture, I realized that this is not happening. But he was still unemployed, right? So around about like November, I had already decided that we needed to go our separate ways. But I wasn't going to be the woman that was going to ask for a divorce while he was unemployed and it would have been difficult for him to, you know, move out, etc. I wasn't going to be like that. That's still the father of my children.
Mm.
As much as we might have our differences, I couldn't do that. So I kept that at the back of my mind saying, you know what, I'm willing to stick it out another 6 months until he gets onto his feet, etc. And as life would be, in January of 2021, we were talking the one day, and then the next day he says, you know what, maybe we should just go our separate ways. He raised it. And I'm like, okay, but you're not working. How are you going to manage, etc.? And so I spoke to my mother about this, and she spoke to my eldest brother. So my eldest brother, 2021, he was relocating to Toronto. And so this happened on a Friday, and then on a Sunday, we had a Teams call, like a Zoom call. His parents, my parents, Neil and I.
Quite a big... This is not a culture experience.
This is a culture experience. This is a culture experience. This is where like the family gets involved.
It's an intervention. Yes. Oh, my word.
So it was my eldest brother, Neil's parents, my parents, and the two of us. We were sitting together. And my brother was like the mediator in all of this. And he said the only reason why they were doing this is because there are two children involved here.
Yes, yes.
And I mean, prior to this, both my brothers actually came and spoke to me to ask me what is going on. And they said the only reason why we're here is because you've got the two children. If the two children weren't here, you and Neil can do whatever you want.
Mm.
But there's two children involved, you know. So, and when my brothers spoke to me, they didn't speak to me from the point of, he's wrong or you wrong or whatever. They came at it very objectively, giving me insight into, you know, their own relationships and how they manage stuff and how they worked stuff out with their wives, right? So my brothers weren't there to tell me, oh, no, Ravishni, you are right and he is wrong. No, they didn't do that. And that's the one thing, you know, I know with my family, they come at you with the truth. You know, not necessarily taking your side, but to give you the different perspectives, right? So when we had this discussion and, you know, my parents had their part, his parents had their part, the main question that was posed was, you know, what do we want? And so my brother asked that question of Neil, you know, what is it that you want? What do you think needs to happen? And he said, well, I think it's best for both of us to go our separate ways. And that was said then, at the end of January 2021. So after that, when we had our joint sessions with the psychologists again, and we spoke about it, and so I was like, okay. So now he said it, he put it out into the universe, and his expectation was, no, we'll still live together, etc. And I'm like, it doesn't work that way. You've just said you want out, right? And even the psychologist said the same thing. You said you want out, so you got to figure out when you're gonna move on.
No, because it's not healthy, really.
No, it wasn't. And so what we had decided was, so the kid's birthday is at the end of March. So I said, after their birthday, you can move out. I think it's fair. So he moved out after their birthday. So in April he moved out, and what we decided was, at the end of the year, we will sort out the divorce. So we weren't, because remember now, you still got emotions. There's still these emotions. And this is what I also tell, you know, other ladies that come and speak to me. I was like, you know what? You don't want to be that woman that's making decisions in a divorce based on emotion.
It's not healthy.
It's not healthy. So we said, okay, I told him, listen, you need to set yourself up, get your place, get a job, etc. When you're in a position to pay maintenance, you can start paying me maintenance, etc., and we move on. So, you know, when he moved out, I had a lot of anger. I had a lot of hurt. There was a lot of resentment. So it wasn't the right time to actually initiate talking about divorce or whatever. When we came towards the end of the year, and I said, November, it's time for us to sort this thing out. So we both sat together. Now, I told him, listen, I don't have the money to get a lawyer. You don't have the money to get a lawyer. Let's figure this out ourselves. And he was like, fine. So I bought, so they actually sell these. You know, you can do a DIY divorce. So I actually bought, I bought a settlement template.
You can buy a DIY.
You can buy a DIY settlement template. Anybody going through divorce, and it's going to be an amicable divorce because you both want it, you can buy it and do it yourself. It's the cheapest way to do it.
Oh my God.
My advice to anybody going through it. So we bought it. We bought it. We sat down together and we filled it in. We filled it in. We spoke about how we would divide stuff. We spoke about the parenting, how it would work. Because up until that point, the girls were just going and visiting him. He'd pick them up for the day, drop them off, etc. They weren't staying with him. But we had put it in there that everything related to the children would be discussed between us and would be a mutual agreement. So, you know, in most instances, you know, it's like 1 week with this parent, 1 week with that parent, etc. No, we said we will decide what is in the best interest of the children. And that's how our settlement agreement was drawn up. And so my sister-in-law's dad's a lawyer, and I asked him. And I even asked Neil, I said, are you okay with Uncle Ajit looking at the agreement? He said, yes, no, it's fine. So he looked at it and he said, you know what, Raveshni, this is a very fair agreement that you guys have drawn up, specifically with the children as well. So we did that. So we got the paperwork. We lodged the paperwork in December. Now, he had already found a job. And I think when they had told him that, when he had told them that he was going through a divorce, he was getting divorced, they were like, okay, we'd like to give you an opportunity to go work outside of South Africa. So he started traveling, commuting up and down between South Africa and Zambia. And because he asked for it, because he said, his words were like, we should go our separate way. I said, well, then you're going to be the plaintiff. You're the one asking for the divorce. I'll be the defendant.
Oh, my gosh. How to do a divorce yourself.
Yeah.
Plaintiff. Okay.
Yeah. So you're the one that asked for it. So you're going to be the plaintiff. I'll be the defendant. Right?
Oh, right.
So,
I love it.
Yeah. So we did it that way.
Very good.
He was out of the country, I told him, listen, because you're out of the country, I'll do all the legwork. Give me a letter that states that you're giving me permission to go to the sheriff, to go to the family advocate, to get all the necessary steps done, which he did. So I did the legwork.
Sure.
So technically...
Holding space.
Yes. So technically I did the job of the plaintiff in doing everything. But it was fine. It's because it needed to happen. And so we came to March... And we needed to find a date for the court date. And so we were looking at it, and I was like, they had the 6th of April open. And I was like, my birthday's on the 8th of April. I was like, I'm taking the 6th of April. And I told him, because he had to figure out his travel. I said, listen, this is the only date they had available. I wasn't going to get divorced late in April. So I was like, okay, so the 6th. And the reason why I chose the 6th is because on the 8th, I was turning 40.
Pure midlife crisis.
I wanted to have all my ducks in a row sorted before I turned 40.
Well done.
And so when the day came, we actually met at the Maslow Hotel. We left one car there. We drove together to the courthouse, Neil and I. Drove together, we got there, we saw we were like number 4 on the roll or whatever, and we sat in the back together. And when it was our turn, they called him up, and the judge asked him, is your wife here? He said, yes. So she called me to the front, I sat down, and she went through the paperwork with me, asked him a few questions, not even 10 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
Done. Before that, we're sitting and we're watching these other people going through the divorce. They've got lawyers and they're arguing this, that, whatever. And I'm like, we went there. It takes you longer to get married.
Isn't
the ceremony itself is longer than if you want to get divorced. And if you're doing it the simple way, getting divorced.
Wow.
Not even 10 minutes.
That is something just to hold on there for a second.
Yeah.
Like how... the celebration part of it, but how something can get go, how something can end so quickly in your life, just like that.
Just like that. Just like that. Hmm. Not even 10 minutes. We left, and I went to work. We both went to work that day.
Looking back, you've gone through a typical midlife crisis, and it looks different for everybody, but we have to call it out so that when this happens in your life, you can actually see it happening. Okay, you give birth to twins, to beautiful twins. You had the difficulty of falling pregnant. You go through the whole process. You go through divorce. Then there's the side thing, pandemic. Then also you've had tremendous loss, which we'll touch on shortly with your father. But also there's the career element and all of it that happened around you. And you had to find yourself, your values. You had to completely go to the deep dark pit. Mm. What is the most profound lessons that you've learned about yourself?
Mm. About myself? There's no such thing as control. Control is an illusion. You cannot control anybody. You cannot control how people are going to react to you. Mm. Or even an outcome. You can only control how your feelings, how you would handle a situation, etc. I used to think I could control everything. And once I realized I can't, it was the most freeing thing ever, because I can only control myself, what I do, and how I react to something. No longer do I actually try to get people to do things the way I think it needs to be done, because I realize nobody's ever going to do it the way I want it done. I'm going to have to give them that freedom and the latitude to do it a certain way. Hopefully the outcome is what the desired outcome needs to be from a professional perspective. But the whole thing for me was about control. I was like fixated on the fact that I needed to be in control of everything to get the right outcome, or that I could change people to be a certain way, to do a certain thing. Like, I saw the potential my ex-husband had, and I thought I could get him to change to be what he needed to be. But I realized you can't change people. You can't control people. You only have control over yourself. And for me, that was a very important thing to learn, that that I can only control myself. Mm. Everything else around me is not controllable.
That's so powerful. And it's one of the tough spiritual laws, right? Mm. Is to work on yourself if you want to see a change in the world. And that's so profound. But I want to understand, how did your father's passing affect your view of life and relationships?
So, you know, I was thinking about this the other night, if you're going to ask me about my dad and how I'd respond. And, you know, I think I only really knew the impact of both my parents when my father passed away. When he was about to be cremated, my cousin did a prayer, and he gave some context into the background, you know, where my father came from. Sorry. His father, you know, my grandfather was a very spiritual man, not very educated. But my father understood the power of education. He was the youngest and the first to actually, you know, get qualified, etc. And then you have my mother, who was the eldest in her family. And when my parents got married, they did a lot for their siblings and their families in terms of making sure that the rest of them were educated. You know, if I look at my cousins and everybody now, they're all very successful. But when my mother told me that, I realized the profound effect my parents had on a lot of people. And I looked at my father very differently. My father had his flaws, right? But he was a very brilliant man. Brilliant. And to a certain extent, that brilliance from both him and my mother has transcended into my brothers, the grandchildren, etc. And that's his legacy. And the strength that I get Like, at my dad's funeral, I spoke on behalf of my niece. And I did not cry. I was very strong. And it's because of the strength I got from my dad. Mm. My father as well. He never really scolded me, shouted at me. My mother was a disciplinarian, not my dad.
Oh, my goodness.
My father was the one that allowed me to make my mistakes and learn from it. And I think when I went through my divorce, when I was going through that process, my father saw me in a different light, I think, after that. He saw that I was no longer that little girl anymore. I had grown up. I had to make hard decisions, difficult decisions. And he never said anything. Like, the one day I sat there, I spoke to him and my mother. And I shared some stuff from the session I had with the psychologist and my father. My father never said a word. He just listened to what I said. Because of, you know, how we grew up, you know, things that happened in childhood, etc. And he didn't say a thing. But after that, I saw the shift in how my father interacted with me.
Sure.
And, you know, and it's from that I realized, you know, you can have a whole lot of flaws, but you can still have the best of intentions for everybody. Mm. And you know, hearing that story that my cousin said about my grandfather and then my father, and then hearing from my mother, you know, this is what they did. And then when I look at my life and I look at what my father has done, my father might not have had everything that you would think you would want in life, but he gave my brothers and I the very best that he could from an education perspective. Mm. He gave us the foundation we needed to be where we are now. He worked really hard, you know, and my father was always about helping others. So my father used to be a maths teacher, so he used to tutor. And we're telling him, yeah, Dad, but you need to be charging this amount. This is what all the other tutors are charging. And he's like, no, he's not going to charge that. He's going to charge this amount. It was more about helping and guiding more than making the money, you know, like most people would look at. And I think to a certain extent, I'm starting to take that from my father in how I interact with some of the ladies at work, the younger people at work that I see, the interns and stuff. When I look at them and I was like, guys, you know, you need to start looking at how are you positioning yourself? How are you presenting yourself? How can I help you? My father did a lot of that. And that's his legacy. My brothers, his grandchildren, we are his legacy. Mm. You know? But now, as a parent, and now when I sit back and I reflect on everything that's transpired in my life, I now understand my father actually better when he's not here.
I know, right?
Than when he was here.
Wow.
And strangely enough, a week before my father passed away, I had decided to buy a new car. Purely for him. Because he had a wheelchair that couldn't fit properly in my mother's car, and my car at the time wasn't the best to do it. So I told him, Dad, I've decided I'm getting this car. He's like, okay, this car. So the following week, I sorted all the paperwork, etc. On the Thursday, the 14th of September, I had just sorted out the insurance and everything for my car. I had left my girls with my parents because I went for netball practice. I come back, I'm sitting there, I'm talking to him, I'm saying, Dad, how are you feeling? How's things? He's like, no, you know, I'm feeling tired. I told him, yeah, but you know, the girls got their concert at the end of the month. You're going to be able to go for that. He's like, no, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go for it. I was like, don't worry. I've made all the plans, all the arrangements. We've got everything sorted at school for you. You know, you'd have your oxygen machine and everything. So just before I left that day, I called the girls. I told them, listen, give Tata a hug and a kiss. We're going to go now. And I told my dad, because he wasn't in the best of health. I told him, listen, I don't want to hug you or anything, but I'll see you. That was like at about 7 o'clock. Just before 11 o'clock, he passed away, same day. What gives me a bit of relief in a sense is that my children got to see him. They got to say goodbye to him, because when I had to tell them the next day that Tata is no longer around, it was very hard. It was very hard.
Mm.
And one of the things when I sat there, before they could take him away, I was thinking to myself, is my father actually proud of me? And my mother came and told me, yes, your father was very proud of you in terms of what you've done, how you've managed to pull yourself back up from where you were to where you are now. He was very proud of you. And for me, you know, my brothers are very successful in what they do. I always thought that I wasn't there with them. But I've realized that all of us are on our own different journey.
Mm.
And success is what you view success as being. And it's not about comparing yourself with anybody else.
Can I get you some tissues? Yeah. I want to get you some.
I realized that, you know, success is what we view it as being. It's not about comparing yourself to anybody else and what they have. It's how have you shifted the needle for yourself from where you were to where you are now.
Mm.
And for me, that is how I now look at how successful I am in what I'm doing. If I look back to where I was in 2020, professionally, personally, and I look at where I am now, I have moved that needle significantly for myself. And I'm proud of the fact that I've done it during a very difficult period in my life where I've had to figure out how am I going to live my life going forward to be able to give my children the best possible life itself. What are the changes I needed to make in my life, personally and professionally? How did I need to push myself? What aspects of my life did I need to change to be where I am now and to constantly move forward? It never stops.
Mm.
You've got to always try and figure out what is it and what is success for you. And I tell this to my kids. I tell them, listen, if today you did something a certain way and you didn't get the desired outcome, it's just about the next day you wake up and you figure out how to do it better.
Mm, I love that.
And I think, and it's something, so I listen a lot to Kobe Bryant, actually. He's, you know, with him, with his whole mama mentality and things like that. And I listen to him, and he's right. It's like, you know, you've really got to work hard at what you're doing. But you've got to work hard to outwork yourself, not anybody else.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
You know, it's so nice. And it's not just him. Other people say the exact same thing. And I watch a lot of the stuff, and I look at it, and I think to myself, yes, you know, we are also our own worst enemy in the sense that we are very critical of ourselves in terms of, you know, if we put something out, is that the best that we can put out? Or is that just an okay version? And sometimes we've also got to realize certain people want the best and other people just want just good enough.
Yeah.
And who needs the just good enough and who needs the exceptional? And then you work your way in both those areas. And so it's a question I ask when I interview people as well for, you know, for positions. That's like, I give them the scenarios. Would you rather be on time but with a subpar, you know, product, or would you rather ask for an extension to give something exceptional? And I say, and for me, the answer is you've got to see who you're giving it to. What are their expectations? Are they expecting the best? Or are they? Or is there just a certain thing that they're looking for? All you got to do is hone in on that certain thing and give it to them.
Yeah.
So I've also had to learn that from a professional perspective is that people have different levels of expectation and understanding in terms of what you need to give them.
Mm.
We think we need to give one thing. They're expecting something else. The thing that we need to give is what takes us the long time that way we want to be truly exceptional in what it is. And sometimes we've got to accept the fact that it's okay to be not there, but here.
Yeah. And I think this is the challenge, is that we continuously can be such perfectionists as well. And perfectionism is also a form of control. You know? You've really gone through a lot. And even when you tell the story, you try and minimize it and not, but I know that you have gone through tremendous pain. and a lot of discovery about yourself. And for me, there's so much grace in your way of delivering your story and telling us your story. And I want to say thank you. Mm. And thank you for making yourself so vulnerable. Mm. And I know that there's so many women watching this and probably going like, oh my word, I can see a part of that in my story. And I think that you've given so many nuggets of wisdom. And I want to thank you today for your vulnerability. I really appreciate it. Really, okay. Really thank you. And maybe, do you have any parting lessons that you want to give to the woman watching? Mm. And what do you think that is a best way for you to fortify yourself?
You know, I think as a woman, okay, well, what I think of is that we always make a plan.
Mm.
A woman will always make a plan, no matter what is happening. Whether you need to sort something out for your kids, something at home, etc., you figure it out. You find where in life you need to make an adjustment,
mm.
a course correction. And then you figure out, okay, this is not what I need to do.
Yes.
And then I move forward. And I think that is something that all women have. You just got to find it within yourself.
Mm.
You know, on how do you get yourself where you need to go. I think the other thing is that I've realized that you've also got to be you've also got to be courageous to make decisions.
Yes.
And to follow through on it and to back yourself.
Mm.
You've got to learn to back yourself. You know, I've learned now how to do that, how to back myself. You know, I sit in some difficult situations professionally and personally, and then I've got to sit there and think to myself, listen, it's a hard decision to make. Not a lot of people are going to like me, but I've got to have a thick enough skin to deal with the outcomes of it.
Yeah.
And I think, and like professionally, I've had to make a lot of decisions. I've done a lot of things where I'm probably not the most liked person, but I've realized, you know what, you want to make a difference, you want to make a change, everybody's not going to like you.
That's so true.
They're not going to like you. They're not going to like the approach you take or how you interact. But you've got to know that what you're doing, there's a reason and a purpose behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a desired outcome. And they might only see that desired outcome later on and realize, okay, this is why she did what she did.
Mm.
To get to that desired outcome.
Mm.
And you know, I used to be a people pleaser. I used to want to have everybody like me and
such a disease, right?
Do things that are gonna like, oh no, that's why we like her, it's because she does it. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
I'm no longer like that, because I think it's also comes to a point where you understand what your contribution, what your value is.
Mm-hmm.
You've got that self confidence back. I think I didn't really have a lot of self confidence in myself. And I've developed that over the last few years. And like, people look at me and they're like, oh, but you're so confident in this and that. I was like, no, it's something you build up over time. When you realize what it is that you want to be doing, what change you want to be affecting, how you want to actually live your life. And for me, you know, my life is now, my children look at me. They look at how I live my life. They look at what I'm doing. They look at me, they say, oh no, mommy eats well, mommy goes to gym, mommy does this, mommy does that. And it's getting them to start thinking of, you know, what they need to be doing. Like, even like the creative side of things, you know, like, I'm a very technical person, my work needs me to be technical, but I also need to be creative. You need to find those creative outlets for yourself. And a colleague of mine of work the other day asked me, you know, how is it that you have time to do so many different things? And I says, you know what, there is the mundane, day-to-day things that you have to do. And you got to find those things that sparks joy in your life, that gives you joy. And for me, it's participating in your social events at work. It's doing stuff with from a social development perspective at work, participating in those events, career days, engaging with the youth, etc. Those things give me joy.
Yeah,
and I make time for the stuff that gives me joy, because they're like, but you've got so many different things, how do you make it work? I was like, I make time for the things that give me joy, because there's the other stuff that has to happen that does not give me joy.
Yeah.
And it's finding that balance. So you've got to find the thing that sparks joy, to give you that balance in your life and that you know is meaningful. Beautiful. And is making a change and a difference.
I love that. Thank you so much for your wisdom.
Thank you.
And to all our audiences out there, we want to say thank you for your time, and please share this with your network, and thank you so much for joining us today. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.